everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And what'd you think of that song? I've been listening to that song as the intro to my show now for 6.5 years. And I don't always get to hear much of it because we just play the beginning of it. But I really enjoy it. I hope you enjoyed that moment. I did. I want to tell you, my brother wrote and performed that piece, Barry Hartglass. You could find out more about him and his work at barryhartglass.com. But I never tire of that little bit of music, so I just had a fun little moment there. I hope you did, too. Did you hear the bass? That's my favorite part. Let's move on to the second part of the program. I want to bring on my next guest, Elise J. Lane, who's the author of a new book, Nonviolence Now, Living the 1963 Birmingham Campaign's Promise of Peace. Elise is a former professor who taught African American literature and culture at UC Santa Barbara. She is author of Coming In From the Cold, a blog in which she analyzes political and social issues through the prism of Martin Luther King Jr.'s philosophy of nonviolence. A student of engaged Buddhism, Elise, in 2012, participated in the year-long Commit to Dharma course offered by the East Bay Meditation Center under the tutelage of Larry Yang. She earned her Bachelor of Arts from Howard University, Doctorate of Philosophy from UCLA, and Juris Doctor from UC Berkeley. She currently lives in Oakland. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Karen, how are you doing? Thank you so much for having me on.
Now, how do you pronounce your first name? I don't know if I was saying it right.
You were close. It's Elise, so it's a long A. And so the two E's are silent. I don't know why my mother did that, but, you know, it's my name. What am I going to do?
Yeah, she wanted to give you more, so she gave you an extra E for bonus. Elise.
An extra bit of silence, one could say.
Yeah, I like it. Why not? Hey, you know, this world, it's all as we make it, and we make it up as we go along. Now, the key is to make it more peaceful than we've been doing. That's the trick.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%, and that's one of the reasons I wrote my book.
It's not easy. It's not easy to act nonviolently, and you go in great detail in your book, kind of giving us a template with history and ideas and quotes and stories to help us do that. Thank you.
Yes. <You're welcome>.
Okay. Now let's just start with the beginning, your title, the Birmingham Campaign's Promise of Peace. Now, can we just go back to that 1963 event? Because, you know, I hate to admit it, but when I was in public school, I don't remember learning about this.
No, not one of those things you learn in public school. In fact, you learn very little African-American history and American history, for that matter, in public schools. It was a pivotal event in the civil rights movement. The first time that children were deployed on the front lines of the struggle. And it made all the difference in the world because people got to see for their own eyes on television the kind of brutality that African Americans faced in the South. And for many people to see children hosed down and have dogs sticked upon them made all the difference in the world in terms of their support for changes in civil rights and in terms of how in terms of dismantling Jim Crow in the South. So it was a very important event. So it actually lasted for quite a few months. So there were different actions during the course of the months. It ultimately was one of the things that compelled President Johnson to act in terms of legislation, voting rights, and so forth. It wasn't the pivotal thing in that regard, but it was one of the many things that gave him some sort of impetus to move forward.
Now, you're promoting nonviolence in terms of when injustice occurs, the reaction shouldn't be an eye for an eye, a tooth for tooth, and getting violent. Instead, it should be resisting and not reacting in a violent way. That's a very hard and a tall order.
Well, I think nonviolence, you know, Martin Luther King put it in, I think, beautiful terms. And when he said that, you know, to speak of self-defense or these kinds of things in the context of nonviolence, it makes about as much sense as asking a soldier who's at war to sort of not put himself in harm's way. The point is to put oneself on the line and to what King called engage in redemptive suffering. That is to say that one steps forward and is willing to suffer in order to change the system and willing to suffer for others. So yes, you may, it's a huge decision because it requires you to confront your fear of death, your fear of bodily harm, and to ask yourself, you know, how committed are you to undoing injustice? But you know, it's not just a matter of promoting it in terms of confronting systems. What I try to argue in my book is that, you know, we've done just a piece of nonviolence. What it really requires of us is that we change the way we live. And so to sort of to come back to that place where it's like, well, you know, it's a way of life and it's a political imperative.
We have to make a lot of changes. There's so many things that are wrong with our system, and you know, I'd like to think that we can work within it, but sometimes I think we just got to start all over and again. Things are really a mess. Now, I just want to. There were so many different things that I noted in the book, and you bring up so many great quotes from Dr. King and many others. So many of them I noted and want to just keep close to my memory. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to bring up. You told one story that really got to me to the point where I want to make an apology. You were talking about feeling good outside in the woods, how you like to go out in nature.
Yes, yes.
And I know that feeling. I love being out in the woods in nature. And, you know, we're all taught, so there or another, with certain fears about what we should be afraid of. Especially as women, you know, we're all afraid of being raped, whatever. And I remember comedians in my circle, Jewish comedians in particular, that would make jokes about how if we saw two African-American men walking down the street, we'd be afraid. But, you know, it wouldn't happen if we saw two little Jewish guys walking down the street because the little Jewish guys, you know, aren't strong and, you know, they can't do anything and everybody laughs. And, you know, and I laughed. But then I realized, wait a minute, then you tell your story about how, you know, you were taught to be afraid of, you know, the white folks if you were alone in the woods and what they might do. And, you know, first of all, I wanted to apologize because, you know, I didn't think when I would hear these comedians, I didn't think of the other point of view, and I felt really bad about that. So I'm sorry.
Well, let me clarify it. You know, I wasn't ever taught to be afraid of white people by my parents or anybody else. I was told to be aware of the potential of violence from them, and so the woods, you know, became this place where I could possibly confront their violence. And what would I do was the question for me. So, you know, it wasn't so much an issue of fear as it is watch out for the people. There's some crazy people out going out into the woods or go out. There's just some crazy people out in the world. And so I understood them to be talking about white people and white men in particular.
Well,
and men generally, to be quite honest.
Yes, I agree with you there. I mean, there really isn't any difference. Crazy people out there of, you know, red, white, blue, yellow, polka dot, whatever. They're just crazy.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, sometimes they're socialized to feel like they have the authority or the right to do some pretty awful things, unfortunately.
Exactly. Right.
I feel
entitled. Yes.
Entitled. That's a good word. Thank you. That's what I was groping for. And I love being out in the woods, and it's a very frustrating thing to know that I can't be entirely at peace alone as a woman in the woods, although I have done some camping in Costa Rica on my own, and everybody told me I was crazy. And and I was more afraid of the humans that I might interact with rather than the animals that were out there in nature.
Absolutely. And it's good to be cautious and to protect oneself, but it's also, you know, it can be paralyzing. And so when you take your history and your stories with you, it can be even more paralyzing. And so the challenge for me was, and continues to be for me, is to understand that I belong everywhere on Earth. I get to roam freely. And I should be able to get to roam freely without having to worry about any harm being done to me. And so that is my birthright. But it's still to negotiate that with the realities and that there are very, frightening people out in the world today.
So how do we feel, a lot of people like to carry a gun or know that they have a gun nearby because it makes them feel safe. And in promoting nonviolence, how do we manage that or have a feeling of security without feeling a need to have that weapon as a crutch?
I think you allow yourself to feel vulnerable, and you understand that to use a weapon, you can hold the weapon as a crutch, but you're buying into a system of violence. So it's to practice on that level is to, like I said, confront your fears of death and harm and to say, and to be willing to be powerful enough to say no and to do that nonviolently. I don't particularly think that guns make any sense whatsoever, and I don't think there's any, indication that they actually create more safety. I think the proliferation of weapons and the increase in violence speaks otherwise. I mean, most people don't know how to use guns. don't bother to learn how, you know, but they go buy one. So, my thought is if you commit to nonviolence and you commit to soul power, you commit to heart power, and you stay committed to that and you follow through.
Okay, now I want to open up and talk more about Chapter 5, which encompasses my favorite subject, which is food, and the things we bring into our bodies. So that can be actual food, or it could be the toxins in the air, the emotions we take in, the thoughts that we take in, food for the soul. It's a big picture. It's all important. I wanted to say that we tend to evolve or improve in increments. And I would like to.
I didn't hear the last part of what you said because the bell rang over your voice. You said we tend to.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I'm disconnecting this phone very soon because I only get the prank callers and spam callers. We tend to evolve in increments where we give women the right to vote. And then we have civil rights acts, and now we're starting to we've allowed for gay marriage, and we're moving along, allowing people to live as they should live with freedom and rights. And it takes time to open the floodgates and allow true freedom for all. And then ultimately, I would like to think that our non-human animals will also be given respect, that comes to how. But it takes a long time and has to work in steps, which I find really, really frustrating. But
I think it's really a matter of political consciousness. So, people have to unlearn the things that they have been taught about what it means to exercise power in this world. So we feel like we've been given nature to exploit. We believe that. Propagated that myth, and it will take quite some time to undo it. And we need to undo it sooner than later because it is a myth that has led to resource depletion, to climate change, and of course to decimation of several species because of the choices that we made and the ideology that we have bought into. So yes, it will take some time, but we don't have much time. And you know, we don't have time to evolve. We have to actually become activated and push our government and our corporations and whoever else to make the kind of changes that we need to make. And it requires also a very different worldview, and to see that we are connected to the world, that we are not masters of other species and other parts, other kinds of life on Earth.
Now, that's important, what you just said. We are not masters of other species. This is something big that we really need to figure out, because we really believe that we are master, that we are better, that we're more intelligent. And as a result,
right,
it limits our possibilities, and it's actually devastating to us.
Yes. You know, it's when Thich Nhat Hanh and talks about interbeing, and that we are all made of non-human elements, that everything that's in the cosmos is required for our life and our survival. When King talks about interrelatedness, that we see ourselves in one another, that has to include the natural world. And if it doesn't, then we're really doing harm to ourselves. And I think that this is getting played out in really awful ways on our planet. So, you know, and it frightens me that we want to go elsewhere to look for other, you know, life in other parts of the universe, and say, well, we're taking our ideology with us, and I don't necessarily think that will turn out well for other forms of life at this point. But
I personally believe that one of the greatest nonviolent acts that we can do is by choosing nonviolent foods at every meal. And
I think we have to, you know, everything that we do, including our eating, should be, you know, reframed in terms of nonviolence, to ask the question, what harm am I participating in? And, you know, our society is complex enough where you just simply cannot remove yourself from doing some harm. But you can become conscious of it and make very different decisions. And I think at the dinner table, we can make those kinds of decisions. And that includes thinking about, you know, the kinds of ways we support corporations that exploit resources and harm animals and so forth.
Okay, so let me ask you what you eat. What kind of diet do you have?
I have a diet that needs to go through nonviolent training.
<I'm>
honest. I mean, to eat something up. I used to be a vegetarian, and then, you know, this was years and years ago. And then and something turned, a light turned on for me, and I started eating meat again. And as I now become more aware of the harm that does, and I become more invested in living a life of nonviolence, I am slowly sort of taking myself back into a vegetarian diet.
Okay, well, I like the way you frame that, nonviolent training. That's very good. I might use that. And, you know, if there's anything that I can do to help you get to a more nonviolent way of eating, I'd be happy to do that. We do that a lot at Responsible Eating and Living.
I appreciate that.
And we do
that.
Our very best to make plant eating not only nutritious, but delicious and fun. And, but, you know, eating plants too can have a certain amount of violence involved, and, in terms of toxic pesticides and herbicides, which we're not only putting into the earth, which gets into our water system and it gets into our food, but the poor farm workers that handle these chemicals, oftentimes not because of them, but because of the people that hire them, they don't follow the safety procedures. Women tend to have tremendous problems with birth, and their children have birth defects, and it's just a disaster what we do.
Exactly. including genetically modifying our food supply. I totally agree.
Yeah. So I'm just kind of curious. I hope you don't mind if we stay on this subject a little, because I love
I
food.
Not at all.
But I always like to, you know, understand. We're so complex and hard to understand, but, you know, how do you manage eating food that you know has come from a violent place?
That comes from a where?
From a violent place, slaughtering animals that have been in factory farms, and
So for one, I try to at least buy, since I buy meat, that I try to buy meat that is not raised in factory farms. And for a lot of reasons, I mean, I've seen the shows, I can't remember the name of it now, the movie that was done on factory farms and animals, and that completely opened my eyes to think of the kind of cruelty involved in producing you know, mass-producing pork and mass-producing beef and so forth. So I try to be real conscious of where I get my food. Often I go to farmers markets, I talk to the farmers themselves, and try to buy local. So paying attention to, or you know, purchasing organic foods, reading my labels to make sure that they conform to certain things, such as they're not genetically modified. I'm just kind of being really conscious and purposeful about the decisions, everyday decisions I make about the food I buy, and not, you know, purchasing items that I think might contribute to more violence in the world, and certainly not contribute to creating stress in my body and in my consciousness.
That's really an important point, because when we consume animals that have been in a very stressful situation, I haven't seen any science on this, but I believe that we're consuming those chemicals of stress and fear, and it becomes a part of us, which doesn't do us any good.
Yeah, I've heard that theory, and you know, I think it's intriguing. I'm not sure how true it is, but I think it's something to think about when we, obviously, our own body chemistry changes when we're under stress and when we're fearful. And so, you know, one has to wonder how that change in chemistry affects those who consume products, meat products and so forth.
We're hearing about so much violence all over the world. We have this horrendous Middle Eastern crisis, and not only is it just horrible with the wars and the violence going on there, but now all these people are trying to move through Europe. Nobody knows what to do with them. We have terrorism in our own country, the United States, even though somehow we don't like to call it terrorism often. When some crazy things happen when somebody goes in and shoots all these people in a church. Where do we begin? Where do we begin with nonviolence? Where do we begin? There's just so much going on.
I may have said this earlier, but I wanted to, you know, I think we have to sort of do away entirely with the public-private split that characterizes how we do and conceive of activism. And so we can come up with, you know, so-called peaceful solutions, but if they're infused with our own violence, then those solutions will last only so long. That we have to reimagine our society from our everyday actions, and then to use that opportunity to sort of transform the structures of violence in our society. So let me just give you an example. I went to a peace rally in Hawaii when we were bombing Iraq, and at that rally, at that peace rally, I noticed a mother and child interacting, and the mother was grabbing the child by her pigtail and yanking it and talking to her, you know, in ways that were clearly angry, and then yanking it again. And I had to ask myself, okay, can those of us who are here actually bring peace, you know? And I looked around and saw other sort of evidence of, you know, non-peaceful ways of being. And then I had to think about my own investments in anger and rage and so forth, and the ways in which every day I sort of play out violence. And I had to ask myself, can I live in a society that I can create from this place? And so I think we have to do both. One is to sort of meet those crises with serious political activism, and that means confronting our government. I think that is of utmost importance, to require that our governments begin to adopt nonviolent domestic and foreign policy. But we also need to do the work ourselves.
Okay, well, you've given us a lot of food for thought today. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
And I enjoyed reading your book, and there's, as I mentioned before, a few sections in there that I'm going to continue to repeat to myself. I think we all need to do that. If there's things that we like or something that gets to us, don't put it aside. Put it out in the front somewhere where you can continue to remember it, because we're constantly bombarded with stuff, and the important stuff seems to just get lost. All right. Well, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food, and all the best with nonviolence.
Thank you,
now. Let's get it.
Thank you very much, Karen.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.